Right, so this is joint work with Sergey Bravi and Robert Koenig. And shallow is going to just mean constant depth. OK, so the first part of the talk, I'll just give an overview of our result. So what is a constant depth circuit? Well, first, let me say, what is a depth D quantum circuit? It has D time steps.
David, can you actually turn off the volume a bit?
Yes.
No, I don't think you can.
Oh. Maybe I could just speak or move this a little closer. Is that better?
Yeah, that's much better.
Okay, great. So a depth D quantum circuit has D time steps, and each time step contains 1 and 2 qubit gates which act on disjoint qubits. So here's a little example. These two gates can be done in one time step because they act on disjoint qubits. So that's the first time step in this circuit. These three gates act on disjoint qubits. They can be done in the second time step, and likewise, this is the third time step. So this is a depth 3 circuit. And in this talk, we're going to be interested in shallow circuits, or what I mean by that is constant depth quantum circuits, for which the depth is constant independent of the number of qubits. And I want to bring your attention to the fact that we're talking about circuits composed of 1 and 2 qubit gates. There is some previous literature on constant depth circuits where, in addition to 1 and 2 qubit gates, you allow the circuit to use an n qubit fan-out gate, which is a C0 with one control and multiple targets, or the other way around. It's an n qubit gate in any case.
Yeah. And the other one is fan-in with
many
controls.
Okay, thanks. Well, in any case, we're not going to be talking about that, so that's the setting we're going to be working with. So let me just say why you might be interested in these circuits. So one reason is just a theoretical question. I mean, how much can we gain by parallelizing our circuits if we only have a constant amount of time to compute? And that sort of dovetails with, to use a business speak word, it dovetails with the prospect of having near-term small quantum computers which may not have error correction, where you want to parallelize as much as possible to fit your gates within the coherence time. OK, so the other nice thing about constant depth circuits is that they have structure, and that structure can be exploited to actually prove things. So here's a selection of results about constant depth circuits. Eldar and Harrow showed that using constant depth circuits, you can't prepare code words of good quantum codes, even though you can do that with polynomial sized circuits. It's also known that if you're only talking about depth 2 circuits, you can classically simulate them. And more general simulation algorithms for constant depth circuits were proposed by Aronson and Chen, but those are super polynomial algorithms. And finally, there is the possibility that constant depth quantum circuits can perform tasks that no polynomial time classical computation can perform. The first evidence for this was given in this pioneering work by Terhal and DiVincenzo, where they showed that constant depth circuits are unlikely to be classically simulable under some reasonable complexity theoretic assumptions. And that has been sort of pushed further in this context of quantum supremacy, and there are some recent results which propose tasks which are supposed to be hard to simulate even if you allow an error in the L1 norm for the output distribution. Okay, so if we believe that constant depth quantum circuits might be able to do something that even polynomial time classical computation can't do, what can we reasonably hope to actually prove? So these results, I should say, about quantum supremacy, they rely on conjectures, both complexity theoretic conjectures as well as other less well-studied conjectures. So what we would like to do is scale down the question and ask something a little bit less ambitious where we could hope to prove something. And so the question we're going to ask is, can constant depth quantum circuits solve a problem that constant depth classical circuits can't? And I talked about constant depth quantum circuits, but now I'm going to say what I mean by constant depth classical circuits. So first let's talk about just a single classical gate. A classical gate computes a Boolean function. So it takes some number of input bits, k, and it has one output bit. But you see the way that the gate is drawn, the input bits come in on the left, and the output bit is now copied to multiple locations. The number of input bits to the gate is called the fan-in of the gate. And the number of times that the output is used is called the fan out. So the fan in here is k, and the fan out of this, what I've drawn here, is 2. And we're going to consider circuits composed of bounded fan-in gates, meaning that the fan-in is a constant independent of n. Of course, in the quantum circuits, the fan-in is at most 2. They're all 1 and 2 qubit gates. But we're not going to restrict the fan-out, which potentially makes this circuit class more powerful than the quantum. I mean, it's sort of like we're allowing the classical circuit a lot more freedom. We're going to let it fan out as much as it likes. Right, so then a depth d classical circuit, again, consists of d layers or time steps of gates. So here's an example with 2 layers. And we are going to consider constant depth circuits composed of bounded fan-in gates. And this class of circuits has a name called NC0. But we're not going to mention that name again in this talk because it's kind of unnecessary. We are going to allow the circuit to be probabilistic, meaning that it has random input bits at the input. But actually, we're going to allow it even more than that. We're going to allow the input bits that are random to be drawn from any joint distribution, not just from a product distribution. So formally, that would be called randomized advice. So it's even more than just a standard randomized circuit. So we're going to give the classical circuit quite a lot of power, seemingly. OK, so I talked about what is a constant depth quantum circuit, what is a constant depth classical circuit. Now I want to talk about what I mean by a computational problem. So you can ask, you know, this question for a variety of different types of problems. You could ask for decision problems where the input is a bit string and the output is a single bit, which is a function of the input. And you can ask, can you get this sort of constant depth quantum circuits beating constant depth classical circuits in that setting? And the answer there is no. And the reason is that if you look at a constant depth quantum circuit and you look at, you know, measuring, say in this example, this output qubit, you can simulate that classically in constant depth because the reduced density matrix of that qubit before you measure it is determined by a constant-sized subcircuit of the full circuit that you can easily identify. And that circuit contains at most 2 to the d qubits. In other words, if you trace that qubit backwards through the circuit, it participates in at most 1 2 qubit gate at every layer. So if you now, you know, every time it participates in a 2-qubit gate, you include the qubit that it participated with. By the time you get back to the input, you've only touched 2 to the d qubit. So like in this example, we would only have to look at this subcircuit to compute the output distribution of that one output qubit.
So
yes?
But is there an issue about precision here? I mean, the classical, I mean, because you have amplitudes.
Mm-hmm.
It's not clear that they can be simulated exactly by classical probabilistic without scaling up the resources.
Yeah, so maybe there is an issue that I'm neglecting.
For the decision problem, if you make it, you know, BPP type thing.
Yeah.
But BPP with constant depth, do you allow amplification? Do you allow, what's the probability?
No, there's not, no, we're not going to allow amplification. But
then it's sensitive to what probability, acceptance probability demand.
Yeah, but let's say I care about whether or not there's a family of, well, okay. Yeah, I haven't thought about it in that level of detail. But okay, so at the same level of detail, you can also see that if you consider a search problem where the input is a bit string x and the output is also a bit string, that's just a function of that input. So in this case, it's like a search problem with a unique solution for each instance. Then for the same reason, you can't get a separation because for every output qubit now, you can get this constant depth circuit and you can just do the same thing all in parallel. Because we don't have a bound on the fan out, all of those constant depth circuits for each of the output qubits can access the same input bits. OK, so then what we're going to look at is something called a relation problem, which is a search problem where there's not a unique solution for every instance. So in other words, the input is a bit string, and the output needs to be, if it's a correct solution, like there's a solution set for each input, and that solution set is not just one bit string, but it could be many. Okay. And so our result is that we describe one of these relation problems, which is solved with certainty by a constant depth quantum circuit. And we prove that a probabilistic classical circuit composed of bound and Fanon gates, so the type of circuit I just described, which solves the problem with high probability, and here I mean with probability greater than 7/8, such a circuit must have depth that increases logarithmically with system size. So that's the result. And we prove this. There are no conjectures. OK, other questions about that?
Is this a like existence proof? Or?
No, there's a specific problem. So yeah, and there's so that's the rest of the talk.
So then, if the depth is not constant, how the quantum goes?
No, the quantum circuit has constant depth and solves the problem.
But suppose if I allow quantum circuit to be, if it's not constant depth, what happens?
What is not constant depth?
I mean, if depth is like for the n or something.
For the classical circuit?
For quantum circuit. Then.
Not following. So we describe a problem, which is one of these relation problems, and then we show that there's a constant depth quantum circuit that solves the problem. Okay. So we never consider quantum circuits except for constant depth one.
Okay.
But then we show that classical probabilistic circuits need at least logarithmic depth.
Okay.
So what is this problem? So now the second part of the talk, I'm going to describe the problem for which, you know, the constant depth quantum circuit solves it and no classical circuit of constant depth solves it. But I'm going to take a little detour and talk about problems where the goal is to hide a linear Boolean function. So you are all familiar with one of these, probably, which is this Bernstein-Vazirani problem. And this is an oracular problem. Here, you're given access to this oracle. It's a unitary that acts on a basis state x and computes a linear Boolean function into the phase. So the linear Boolean function is parameterized by a secret bit string z. So this in the exponent here, z, this is z transpose x. So that's the dot product mod 2. Okay. So this is an oracle that you're given in this problem. And your goal is to identify the secret bit string z. And the Bernstein-Vazirani algorithm is just apply Hadamards to all the qubits, apply the oracle once, apply Hadamards to all the qubits, and you get z. So you only need one query to the quantum oracle. But a classical algorithm needs n queries. Now, this is maybe interesting, but it's not as well. One reason to be skeptical is that this speedup is relative to an oracle. And so it's not guaranteed to be meaningful in the real world. So then you might ask, where else could we hide a linear function, a linear Boolean function? And so now we're going to see an example of a problem where it's not oracular and the Boolean function is hidden inside a quadratic form. OK, so the quadratic form is somehow going to live on a grid. So let's define G to be an n by n grid graph with vertex set V and E. So here's an example that I've drawn. And so like capital N is the, you know, it's an n by n grid, but little n is the total number of vertices. Okay? So it's capital N squared. And now we're going to choose a bit for every edge and a bit for every vertex. So the bit for every edge is going to be capital A sub E, and the bit for a vertex is B sub V. And so for any choice of coefficients, we're going to define a quadratic form. And the quadratic form maps bit strings to elements of Z4. So here it is. It's a sum. The first term is a sum over edges of the grid. And the coefficient for that edge multiplies twice the product of the bits for the vertices that touch the edge. And then the second term is just a sum over vertices with the coefficients for each vertex, BV. And the sum here is mod 4. Okay. So this is just defining a quadratic form, Z4 valued quadratic form, from a set of coefficients that live on this grid. So now we're going to see how this quadratic form hides a linear function. I'm going to say that, you know, like I'm going to define this set, but you can almost immediately forget about the set, like the definition. So, you know, if you don't process it, it's not that important. Here is a set which is defined only in terms of the quadratic form. It's a subset of n-bit strings. I mean, it's defined in this way. You can read the definition, but as I said, the only important thing is that it's a set that depends only on the quadratic form. It's a subset of n-bit strings. Okay, so here's the sense in which the quadratic form hides a linear function. So the first part of this lemma says that this set is in fact a linear subspace of F2 to the n. And the second part is the part which talks about linear functions. It says there is some secret bit string Z such that if you only look at the action of Q on bit strings in this subspace LQ, then in fact Q is a linear Boolean function. I mean, with a 2 in front. Okay. So, I mean, it's a little bit funny because since we're only looking at bit strings in this subspace L sub Q, this secret bit string Z is not unique. So you can take Z and add to it any element of LQ perp, and you get an equally valid secret string. And we're going to consider a computational problem where the goal is to find this secret bit string. So here's the problem. The input is the coefficients on the edges and vertices of the grid. So those coefficients uniquely specify this quadratic form and this linear subspace. And the output is this secret bit string such that when you restrict the quadratic form to this subspace, it has this linear, you know, it's a linear function with a secret bit string Z. And as I said, each instance in general has many valid solutions Z, and that's why it's a relation problem, not a search problem. Okay. So now, are there questions about the definition?
So this secret string always exists.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Actually, pretty much after this slide, you can, if you like, forget about the definition of the problem, because after this, we're only really going to talk about the circuit which solves the problem, which I'm going to show you next. And that circuit is, in a lot, many ways, sort of simpler than the definition of the problem itself. Okay, so I'm going to jump ahead to that. So here is the quantum algorithm which solves this problem. There are three registers. The first two just contain the input bits, B and A. The third register has little n qubits, which means one qubit for each vertex of this grid. And so the first thing you do is you apply Hadamard to each qubit. The second thing you do, now I haven't defined what this Cz of A is, so I'm defining it now. This Cz of A, it looks at the input A on all the edges, and whenever there's a 1, like whenever one of those input coefficients is 1, you apply control Z between the qubits on that edge. Okay, so that's that. Then this S of B, what it says is, you look at all the input bits B, and everywhere that coefficient is 1, you apply a phase gate to the qubit sitting at that vertex. The phase gate here is, I mean, it's defined slightly differently from the standard phase gate. It's not, you don't have, this is not important for any reason, but there's a minus 1 there, instead of a minus I instead of an I. Okay, and then you apply the Hadamard again, and then you measure the output Z. Okay? And so in the next slide, I'm going to show you that this algorithm solves the 2D hidden linear function problem. In fact, the output is a uniformly random solution. And the second thing I'm going to show is that it can be implemented in constant depth, which maybe you can already see. I mean, it's kind of trivial. OK.
So
sorry, I'm confused. Mm-hmm.
So capital A is qubits living on edges?
No, sorry. A and B are the coefficients which define the input. So those are bits. Sorry, A is a bit string, mm-hmm. and there's one bit for every edge of the grid. Mm-hmm. So and B is also a bit string, and you have one bit for every vertex of the grid.
Then Cz act on A.
Yeah, so
small n, okay. Small n is okay.
Is it, it's clear? Or? So this Cz of A, what it means, it's just shorthand, what it means is every edge where you have a coefficient 1, mm-hmm. apply Cz to the qubits that live at the vertices that touch that edge.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. So now I'm just going to show this thing that I just claimed, which is that the output is a uniformly random solution. I mean, I'm not really going to show it. I'm going to show the proof sketch, but it's not much more than what I'm going to show. This is somehow like, it's not really a hard proof.
I'm sorry, what is SV?
Oh, yeah, yeah. So SV is, you look at the input bits that are on the vertices, and everywhere you have a 1, you apply a phase gain.
Oh, so SV just up zone.
Yeah, yeah. So now let me just sketch the proof that says that, I mean, the lemma says that the output is a uniformly random solution to this problem. So we're going to first define the product of Cz of A times S of B. And let's call it U sub Q. Then it's not hard to see. Well, first of all, it's obvious that this is a diagonal unitary, diagonal in the Z basis. But it's also true that its action on basis states is just to compute I to the Q of Y, where Q is the quadratic form defined by A and B. So this is somehow similar to the like oracle that appears in the Bernstein-Vazirani problem, except that there you have negative 1 to the L of, you know, to a linear function. Here we have I to a quadratic function. So then the output distribution of the above circuit is then just like the Fourier transform of UQ, or sorry, of I, the function that's I to the Q. So it's written here. So yeah, it's the square of the Fourier transform. OK, so then the rest of the proof is just sort of like it's a combination of standard Fourier transform manipulation and then using properties of quadratic forms. So what we do is we divide up the full vector space F2 to the n into like LQ plus like a sum of vector spaces plus some other space M. And then we write the Fourier transform as a product of partial Fourier transforms over those subspaces. And then, well, I said I wasn't going to do the whole proof, really. But what we do is we show that the first term, the partial Fourier transform over this linear space LQ, you see, this I to the Q of Y, when you restrict to inputs in LQ, we know this has the property that it's a linear function. It's 2z transpose x. So then you can use that fact and standard facts about the Fourier transform to show that this is 0 whenever z is not a solution, and it's some other constant when it is a solution. And then this other part turns out to be constant independent of z. And that you need to use properties of, or we prove it using properties of quadratic form. So this is not like a super hard proof, and maybe it gives a little bit of intuition, or you can see why it's sort of similar to the Bernstein-Vazirani. So now let me describe how you implement the algorithm in constant depth. It's sort of obvious, I guess. I mean, these three gates, or sets of gates, can be implemented in one time step each. So that it's obvious for these Hadamards, but the S of B gate is just a sequence of, or you can apply it in one layer of controlled S gates between the B register and the data register. For the Cz of A gate, because the geometry is that of a 2D grid, you can do it in four layers. So like the even, you take the even and odd and vertical and horizontal edges. And so for each combination, you do one layer of gates, which can be done in parallel. And so then it's four layers of controlled Z gates. And then if you want, you know, I said I was going to do 1 and 2 qubit gates, then you can decompose those into 1 and 2 qubit gates. OK. But one interesting feature is that in practice, probably you wouldn't want to do controlled Z gates. Well, maybe you've observed that the algorithm only requires actually classically controlled Clifford gates on the input. So, so let's do an example. I mean, here are.
I'm sorry, why you need a CCV?
Well, like in this circuit.
Yeah.
This Cz of A, it's a controlled Z, like it's a sequence of controlled Zs that themselves depend on A.
Oh, sure.
So you have to, you know, but of course, like all the gates that act on the data register are Clifford gates for any fixed input. So they're classically controlled Clifford gates. So like in practice, you know, here's an example. Imagine that you place a qubit in each vertex, and you, here I'm going to represent the input as just these like, you know, let's say that there's a 1 on the edge whenever the edge is red, and the B coefficient is 1 whenever the vertex is green. So this is like some input. Then what I would do in practice is I would apply Hadamard everywhere. I do my CZs in 4 layers, so I cover all the red edges. And then I apply the S gates whenever I have a 1 on the vertices, and then I apply Hadamards again and measure. Okay, so it's all classically controlled Clifford. Now, of course, what this means is that this problem we've defined has a classical polynomial time solution, because you can simulate all these Cliffords for a given input using the Gottesman-Knill theorem. Okay, so it's a linear algebra problem. Okay, so just taking stock, so far we've shown that this 2D hidden linear function problem is solved by a constant depth quantum circuit, and moreover, you can take all the gates to be classically controlled Cliffords acting locally in 2D. And so we're going to show that even that restricted class of constant depth quantum circuits can't, you know, can do something that constant depth classical circuits can't. And that's going to be the next part of the talk.
So control control Z is not Clifford.
Control control Z is not Clifford.
And so that's the part which gives kind of extra power to the quantum circuit.
No, no. Oh, maybe you're confused because I said it has a polynomial time classical solution.
Yeah.
So it has a polynomial time classical solution, but it can't be done in constant depth.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Okay, I see. Okay.
Okay, so I guess our main technical result is the classical lower bound, which I'll talk about next. So here is the theorem. It says that let's take this grid size to be sufficiently large, so larger than some fixed constant. And then let's suppose that you have a classical probabilistic circuit composed of bounded Fanon gates. And suppose that this circuit solves size n instances of this problem. And the output of the circuit has to be a solution with probability greater than 7/8. Then under those conditions, the depth of the circuit is at least log n over 8 log k, where k is the Fanon. So if k is constant, this is omega of log n. Okay, so let me now, I said it in words, but I'm going to say the same thing in pictures. So the circuit here for size n instances takes as input the coefficients a and b for edges and vertices of the n by n grid. It also takes in random bits, as many as you like, in fact. And they can be drawn from any joint distribution, not just a product distribution. And the circuit has to output a solution to that instance with probability greater than 7/8. And the theorem says what I said in red here, that if under these conditions, the circuit must have depth omega of log n. Okay. So how do we prove that? The idea is that there's a type of locality in constant depth classical circuits. And what I mean by that specifically is that in a constant depth classical circuit, every output bit can only depend on a constant number of input bits. So that's a type of locality. But there's a tension between that and quantum non-locality in the sense of Bell, like Bell test. So we know that the measurement statistics of entangled quantum states can't be reproduced by local hidden variable models. And so we're going to exploit quantum non-locality, which is generated by constant depth quantum circuits, but nevertheless thwarts constant depth classical circuits. These are pictures of Bell and Merman. Okay. So I'm going to talk about both of these things. I'll start by talking about locality in classical circuits in a little bit more depth. So, I mean, here, let's just say C here is just some generic classical circuit. It has depth D and Fanon at most capital K. It takes as input a bit string X. So here the bit string includes all the random bits, like in the previous case. And it just computes some function of X. So Z here is just a function of X, f of X. So we're going to say that a bit of the input is correlated with a bit of the output if on some input string, flipping that bit can flip that bit of the output. Okay, so that's what we mean by an input bit being correlated with an output bit. It's the obvious definition. And then we're going to define the light cone
of any output bit to be the set of all input bits that are correlated with it. Okay? Is that, that's okay? So then, what I'm going to mean when I say constant depth locality is the following property of constant depth circuits. So if you have a circuit of depth d and fan in at most k, the light cone of any output bit, the size of it, is at most k to the d. Because every time, like imagine starting at the end of the circuit at that output bit and going backwards through each layer, the number of bits that determine the, you know, start at the output bit, now look at the bits in the previous layer that determine that bit, there's at most k of them. And you go back d layers, you get at most k to the d. So if d is constant and k is constant, this is a constant sized light cone for any output bit. So we're going to call that, yes?
A quick question. When you say can flip, you mean flip with probability. That's positive.
No, because here x includes the random bits. So, you know, f of x is a deterministic function. And x, like for if you're considering probabilistic circuits, x would include random bits. But we, you know, you could say that a random bit is correlated with, yeah. Is that OK? Yeah. So. OK, so this is what I'm going to call constant depth locality. And it's a feature of constant depth circuits. And what we're going to see is that the 2D hidden linear function problem can't be solved by constant depth local circuits. But before I show that, I want to consider some simpler forms of locality. Like I'm going to start with one that you've already seen. So let's talk about completely local circuits. And so there, we're going to talk about the standard GHZ gain. And we're going to see how it sort of thwarts simulation by a very local type of circuit. I mean, I'm just going to reinterpret what you already know about the GHZ gain. So we're going to start with this 3-qubit GHZ state. And it's a stabilizer state. And here are four elements of its stabilizer group. So now I want to imagine an experiment where you choose three bits, B1, B2, B3, and then you measure each qubit of the GHZ state in either the x or the y basis, depending on the bit that you chose for that qubit. So then you get three outcomes, which are z1, z2, z3, which are -1 or +1. And using these stabilizer equations, it's not hard to see that you satisfy the following, what I'll call the GHZ relation. So it's a relationship between the input bits, B1, B2, B3, and the output bits, which are the measurement outcomes, Z1, Z2, Z3. Here, I is the square root of -1. So like, let's take an example. Like, suppose B1, B2, and B3 are all 0. Then what that means is that we're measuring each qubit in the x basis. But since the GHZ state has XXX as a stabilizer, we have to get +1. So that's the case, B1 equals 0, B2 equals 0, B3 equals 0. And there's three other cases that satisfy this condition. And those correspond to the three other stabilizers that I've shown above. So this is just a relation that's satisfied by this GHZ Bell test. But we know that it can't be, I mean, we know from Merman and Greenberger and others that it can't be satisfied by a local hidden variable model, which you can interpret as a completely local classical probabilistic circuit. And what I mean by completely local here is that each output bit is correlated with at most one of the input bits. So typically, you assume that the output bit is correlated with its corresponding input bit. But of course, there's a symmetry. So you can, without loss of generality, say that, well, what I've said here. OK, so this is an example where quantum locality can't be reproduced by these completely local circuits, where every output bit is determined by one input bit and maybe some shared randomness. So now let's move up to something that's slightly slightly different. So now we're going to consider geometrically local circuits. So this is an example due to Barrett et al. And instead of the GHZ state, now we're going to start with a graph state, which is defined on an M cycle for where M is even. And here's the definition of the graph state on an M cycle. And what we're going to do is a similar Bell test experiment. So we're going to choose three qubits on the even sublattice of the M cycle. And we're going to measure those qubits, the three qubits, in either the x or y basis, depending on some input bits. And we're going to measure all the other qubits in the x basis. So here's a picture. So each circle here is a qubit of the graph state, and I've drawn in the circle the measurement bases that we're going to do a measurement in, single qubit measurement. So the qubits u, v, and w, we measure in either the x or the y basis, depending on some input bit. And the other ones, we always just measure in the x basis. Now this has the feature that actually if you do all the green, if you measure all the green qubits first, the remaining state on the u, v, and w is actually either the GHZ state with a plus in the middle, like 0, 0, plus 1, 1, 1, or the GHZ state with a minus. And so if you consider like the input-output behavior of this experiment, so the input is the three measurement bases for the vertices, the output is the measurement outcomes for all the qubits, then the input and output satisfy what I'll call a cycle relation, which is similar to the GHZ relation I just showed because of this. It's actually a sort of direct extension of that. There's an additional correction which comes from the measurement outcomes on the green qubits. But I'm not even going to write down what the relation is because we don't need its functional form for any reason. So the fact that I'm stating is just that there's some relation satisfied between the input, the measurement bases of u, v, and w, and the output, which is the measurement outcomes for all the qubits. So I'm going to call that the cycle relation. And so then you can prove the following lemma, which is suppose that there's a classical circuit that satisfies this cycle relation between its input and output. So it takes as input these three bits, bu, bv, bw, outputs m bits, z. And suppose that that classical circuit satisfies this cycle relation with probability greater than 7/8. Then what you can say is that that classical circuit has to be geometrically non-local, meaning that some output bit is correlated with a distant input bit. And what I mean by distant is like, suppose you're looking at the output bit corresponding to this measurement outcome. Like, this would be a distant input bit, or that one would be, but not this one. So what I mean is like not the nearest input bit. That's what I mean by distant. So this Barrett et al. Were interested in something called communication-assisted local hidden variable models. And this is a variant of their construction, and it's phrased in terms of circuits, but it's essentially the same. Okay. So now you might be asking yourself, what does this have to do with this 2D hidden linear function problem? And it's actually directly related to it. So here's the circuit that we saw earlier outputs a uniform solution to the problem. So let's look at the way that circuit is organized. If you look at the first two gates acting on the data register, what it does is it actually prepares the graph state for the graph with adjacency matrix A, just by definition. The last three things that you do, the application of this S gates, the H, and then the measurement, that's equivalent to measuring each of the qubits in either the x or the y basis, depending on the input bit b sub j. So it really does have the form of this Bell test that we've been talking about. And so using the Bell test that we were just talking about, we can infer some features of this circuit. So let's say we focus on inputs where A describes the adjacency matrix of a cycle, like in the previous example. Then if we choose the measurement bases B appropriately, then we can infer a cycle relation that has to be satisfied by the input and the output. This is the same relation that was in the previous example. And so now if you have a classical circuit which solves the 2D hidden linear function problem, it also has to satisfy this cycle relation, and it has to do so for all possible inputs that describe cycles. And so we're going to show that that leads to a contradiction if the depth is too small. So now this is the final slide where I'm going to describe our proof. Now we're going to move to this constant depth local setting. And what you can show, I mean, there's a purely classical argument, which is just a probabilistic argument, which uses this fact that every output bit has a constant size light cone. And it shows the following. So suppose that this classical circuit that you're given, it has depth less than this threshold log n over 8 log k. Then using a probabilistic argument, you can always find three vertices u, v, and w on the grid, actually on the even sublattice, and a cycle, which I've drawn here in red, which passes through all of them. And moreover, these input bits corresponding to these u, v, and w are not correlated with any distant output bits on the cycle. So again, this just the proof of this just uses this fact that every output bit has a constant sized light cone and that there's many cycles. So you can always find one with this property. But because we just said that to satisfy the cycle relation, you have to have this like non-local correlation in the cycle. So what this means is that this circuit that we're given, with which has depth less than log n, it can't satisfy with high probability the cycle relation for that cycle that we just found. And so the circuit doesn't, with high probability, solve instances of this problem where A describes the adjacency matrix of this cycle. OK, so that's how we prove the lower bound on the depth. So we said, if the depth is too small, you can't solve all the instances. And therefore, the depth has to be big. Are there questions? That's the end of the description of the proof.
Is there any upper bound for the best possible? Is there any?
Well, it's linear algebra, so it should be in NC. Like, it should be possible to do it in polylogarithmic depth, but I'm not sure if it can be done in like log to the power 1. Yeah. Okay. So this is my last slide. I just have a bunch of open questions. So the first one is, what if we consider stronger class? I mean, we already considered classical circuits which are sort of seemingly more powerful than the class of, you know, than constant depth classical circuits, because we allowed the classical circuit. Than constant depth quantum circuits, I should say. I mean, we allowed the classical circuits already to have unbounded fan out, and we allowed them to have randomized advice. So we gave them a lot of power, but you could give them even more power. You could say there's a class of circuits called AC0, where you have unbounded fan in and unbounded fan out. And we could ask, can you prove that such circuits can't simulate the output of this distribution? Or, sorry, that they can't satisfy this relation. So I don't know. Another question is, so this Bernstein-Vazirani problem, maybe the more interesting feature of it is that you can define a recursive version, which provides a super polynomial speed up in query complexity. So it's reasonable to ask, you know, is there any use in defining a recursive version of this hidden linear function problem? And, you know, what could you use that for, or how do you define it? I don't know. Okay, this actually, so this final open question is actually the problem we wanted to solve, but didn't. So you could ask, can you sample from a distribution with constant depth quantum circuits that can't be sampled by any classical constant depth circuits? So what I mean is, like, for every like system size n, like for every integer n, there would be like a quantum circuit, like a family of circuits indexed by number of qubits. And applying that circuit to all zeros and then measuring, you would sample from some distribution. But then the hope would be that like no classical circuit family, which has the same feature except that it's classical and constant depth, could sample from those from that distribution. So that's, we don't know how to show that or if it's true, but one thing that seems like a useful tool is there is a paper by Emanuele Viola from 2014 where he shows that the distribution sampled by this constant depth classical circuits, these NC0 circuits. So if you have like random input bits, then you apply this circuit and look at the output. The distribution sampled by those classical circuits have a structure, like he proves a structural theorem about such distributions. And in particular, he shows that they can be decomposed as a convex combination of simple distributions with comparable min entropy. And that seems like something that you might want to use if you're trying to prove this thing, and we did try to use it. But anyways, I'll end there. Thank you. Yes?
Do you have any idea? I mean, so we know we can simulate depth two circuits. I'm guessing, like, how low can you get this depth down to, like, four or something?
Well, yeah, so it depends on the gates that you use.
With two qubit gates.
With two qubit gates, maybe let's allow three qubit gates, because then you can get the depth a little bit lower.
Well, I mean, if you chose, like, a trivalent graph instead of a
lattice,
then you should be able to get that down to three, and the controlled sets,
yeah.
You could just, like, split each edge up, in, mm-hmm. so it's got a qubit at the middle, and then do actual control from the input, so you measure in Z to destroy that edge in the cluster state, right? Or you measure in X to not destroy it. I mean,
yeah.
You can actually do this with four.
But I think when you measure in Z, it destroys the edge and applies a correction, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, but the correction matters. So, like.
But you can modify the problem, right? So that. Because the correction will be in another set of registers, so you.
No, but like here, well, okay, maybe, I mean, I'm not sure if something like that could work, but like in this example, the difference between this example and the GHC example is that you have these measurements of these green qubits. And there, no matter what measurements you make, the qubits on UV and W are left in this GHC plus or GHC minus state. But you have to know what those measurements outcomes are to know which of those two you're in. And so there's a correction that depends on those measurement outcomes, the green measurement outcomes, that you need to factor into that comes into this relation. So, like, you know, that's why I didn't write down the cycle relation, because it has some complicated functional form that depends on the correction. So when you have a correction, you have to have a version of, like, what I'm saying is the GHC is like, we know how it works, we have this relation, it's simple. But then when you have this version where you have corrections, you have to make sure that it still works in the presence of those corrections. Yeah.
So, I mean, yeah, like my more general question was, do you have any idea where the transition lies? I mean, do you think this could get down to three or like four?
Oh, I don't know.
So on? I mean, for some other problem.
Yeah, I don't know. That's a good question.
Step two, the simulation was with constant depth classical.
Sorry?
So, like you mentioned, like the for depth two quantum circuits.
Yes, it can be classically efficient.
Constant depth classical circuits.
For depth two.
Yeah, but it's a.
Oh, is it constant depth classical circuits? That I don't know actually.
Okay.
All I know is that it's efficient, but I'm not sure if it's.
Because you mentioned that you can do the classical simulation, but it's just like a logarithmic. There probably are maybe more than them, but you can simulate classically here too.
Yeah. Okay.
All right, well, thank you again.